Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston, CA.
The inner workings of a presidential administration are the most fascinating and least public aspect of governance. This is where the talents, energies, and emotions of the men and women serving the president combine or clash in the furtherance of an administration's programs. Those who serve at this level are more than eyewitnesses to history. They are among its authors, and their accounts of service provide valuable insight into the full story of our political history, replete with its triumphs and failures. There are few periods of American history more fraught with tragic drama and lofty triumph than the successive presidencies of John Fitzgerald Kennedy and Lyndon Baines Johnson. As counselor to both presidents, Lee C. White was close to both men and involved in the work of their administrations. His memoir, Government for the People, reacquaints us with a pivotal moment in American history. My guest is Lee White, author of Government for the People. Lee, welcome to Dialogue.
Delighted to be here, George.
It's great to have you. Let me hold your book up for everyone to see it, and we hope to get a chance to read it. And, you know, it really does do an awful lot, Lee, to not just recapture two administrations and much more, but a mood of the country. And let me ask the first question this way. You came to Washington as a young former Army officer, and your generation has just won World War II. You were about to embark on major domestic change in America and, of course, experience the beginning of the Cold War. I wonder if you can cast yourself back to the very roots of the story recounted in this book. What was the mood like? Was there a sense of palpable excitement about what government can do? Was this Washington the place to be?
Well, as a Nebraskan, when the war ended, I came back from, by the way, nobody ever shot at me and tried to kill me, so I was one of the lucky ones. I had occupation duty in Japan. I came home to Nebraska. Now, Nebraska isn't exactly a place where it was sort of teeming with all sorts of big, powerful ideas like we have here, or we think we have here in Washington. But when I graduated law school, I knew that I wanted to at least sometime work for the federal government. Part of it had to do with sort of a boyhood hero. George W. Norris, United States Senator from Nebraska, was indeed a very, very fine fellow. And although I didn't meet him personally, I saw him speak, and I did believe that you get a lot of things can get done in the government.
Right.
And so I wanted to have a crack at it. And the first chance that I got, I wrote a few letters to the general counsel of different agencies, and one of them said, stop and see me. That was at the Tennessee Valley Authority
exactly.
In Knoxville, Tennessee.
So you came with already inspired with the ideal of public service right from the start, and because of the example of the very great George Norris.
Yeah, that really did give me a bit of a push.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't mean to say that I didn't want to necessarily do other things, but at least somewhere along the route I wanted to experience idea of being a part of the federal establishment.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I encourage a lot of other people to do the same as college graduates. I talked to them just earlier last month.
Yeah, I'm so glad you're still doing that. You know, and I'm so glad also you mentioned your Nebraska roots, Lee, right at the start, because that was quite a law school class you were in. Ted Sorensen was one of your friends, classmates, and of course later colleagues in the Kennedy White House. And one of the first things that I wanted to get to on before we even turn to the Kennedy White House is something you say very early in this book about Sorensen, who's still very much on the scene.
Oh, yes.
And very much concerned with the Obama campaign as it's been developing. One of the points you made here most powerfully was that when people think of Ted Sorensen, they do him an injustice. They fail to understand that he was much more than a speechwriter. That he was very much a formulator of policy. Maybe you could elaborate on that just a bit.
A lot of people write speeches, but very few people have the connection with the principle that Ted Sorensen had, and there was no question about it. There's nothing demeaning about being writing speeches for others, but it was interesting. He appeared here in Washington at the Politics and Prose, a bookstore, and somebody said to him, do you want to be known as a speechwriter? He said, well, I'm kind of like to be known as a lawyer, and I've been a lawyer. He said, but the truth of the matter is, I don't mind being a speechwriter, especially for John F. Kennedy, because some of his speeches are really going to be classics and studied by others. In fact, he said, I have a headline for my obituary. Ted Sorensen, speechwriter for JFK, dies at 104 at the hands of a jealous husband.
That'll get attention.
Yeah. Well, it was a cute line, but it really did demonstrate that this guy was right up there.
Yeah, he still is. His wit, his spirit, like yours, are, you know, it really is a remarkable group. I think that's one of the reasons this book is such a delight and it's so great to talk to you. And another reason it's a remarkable group, Lee, is you and Sorensen and just a couple of other people. There were only about three or four of you. I mean, a very small number of people in this council's office.
Really too small.
Really too small, because let me just, I only wrote down four or five of the things you dealt with. Civil rights, Department of the Interior issues, Veterans Administration, agriculture, narcotics, and anything else that was in the job description and beyond that. How did you organize, and we're talking about this at the presidential level, you're doing this for the President of the United States' counsel to him. I could triple that list right here, and there was more besides. How could you organize that? How did you go about doing that?
Well, first of all, we had no difficulty dealing with the federal establishment. At the time, the Bureau of the Budget, now OMB, Office of Management and Budget, had some people in it who really were very, very knowledgeable. And we could tap in to that group and use them as resources. And also, for example, in the field of education, health, education, and welfare, here's Wilbur Cohen, Assistant Secretary, Undersecretary, and Secretary of HEW, who all of us knew. And all he had to do is call. Somebody once, I thought he was a wise guy, he said, I'm an expert in the Social Security program. I thought, what a pompous fellow. Then he defined it. He said, an expert is somebody who has Wilbur Cohn's phone number. And that's what we did.
Well, you're talking about government at a much more personal, direct level than anything we can think of today.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. In your book, you depict across from the Rayburn Building, I think it is, there was a Carroll Arms Hotel with a bar. And it seems like a lot of work actually got done in just the contacts between people.
Well,
a certain kind.
Yeah, of a certain kind. And, it was across the street from the Senate office building. And one great story was the very close vote on the Bricker Amendment. And a senator from West Virginia sort of had to be steered in. And he had already been at Carroll Arms for a while. And the Bricker Amendment died. It required a two-thirds vote, as it says, a constitutional amendment, when the senator from West Virginia said no. And everybody knew that the Carroll Arms had come through.
The book gives us a remarkable insight into how legislation and legislative advances are made in this country and how sensitive policy issues can be. And I want to turn to certainly the major domestic interest of the Kennedy administration, civil rights, and your work and of course, JFK's leadership in that area. Let's talk a bit about that leadership. One of the first things I think I got from this book, and tell me if I'm wrong on this, Lee, was that because things were so sensitive, because Congress was, it certainly had a strong segregationist element in the Congress in those years, that there was a lot of delicacy about how JFK would advance these notions, and he tended to make strong use of the executive order approach. Is that right?
That is absolutely correct. Mm-hmm. The congressional committees, both House and Senate, were heavily populated. The chairmen were mostly Southerners. just through the fact that they tend to keep their people in office, and the seniority system raises them to important positions on those committees. And so we had people who were, for example, Congressman Jimmy Roosevelt was gung-ho for some stuff, but it was legislative, and we didn't believe that it was possible. And you don't want to start something that you're not going to be able to finish. But the president did have a lot of executive powers that he could use. He created a committee on equal employment opportunity and made Vice President Johnson the chairman. Later, that became a government agency when it was codified into law. But at that time, it wasn't as effective as it might have been, but it was a good start. When he was a candidate, Senator Kennedy said that if Eisenhower would simply take a pen and sign the Housing Act, housing executive order, we could go a long way. Well, after Kennedy was president, maybe about a year or so, people started sending pens in so he could use the pens.
Right.
And they wound up in my office. And that's when President Kennedy did sign an executive order in housing. So, it was controversial in how far it went, but it was that. He created a commission under Gary Gazelle, who later became a federal district judge, to implement the Truman idea.
Absolutely.
Of desegregating the military.
As did you witness, in your opinion, Lee, an evolution in Kennedy's approach to these matters? For example, even with the executive order approach, there becomes a point when he is willing to go to legislative remedies, does there not? And if that's correct, what produced that, and did you think the man himself was evolving in the way that he was looking at the issue?
Yeah, well, there's no question about it. It was easy for him. It may not have been as easy for others who may have been Democrats from the South. But from Massachusetts, there was no problem at all from a constituency point of view. But mostly, it was perceived by the leaders in the black community that here was a friend. Eisenhower wasn't exactly, he did a few things. The Little Rock thing was a courageous thing to have done, but whether it was courageous or he had to do it, the main difference, it was done. But there wasn't a feeling that there was a friend at court. When Kennedy came along, there was no question about it. And so we would have meetings with the leadership, and they didn't mind explaining to us what we ought to be doing.
Yeah.
And we would sometimes be a little bit on the defensive, but mostly we would be okay. Mm-hmm. And then, without any effort on the part of the administration, the leadership came up with that great idea of the March on Washington in August 1963.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, that was a blockbuster. And that's where Dr. King emerged as a leader of enormous proportions. And made progress.
That became a catalyst in itself.
Yeah.
You know,
that great voice, the cadence, and the great speech. The
rhythms. I think we all remember, those of us
yeah.
who were there at the time. And of course, that's everything of that era is very faithfully brought forth here, including the single most awful day, of course, and the one that you give us a very personal recollection of, and that's the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, which made you for that period. I mean, it was obviously as they say, all of us remember where we were and what was going on. And you had to be acting press secretary, is that right, in that period?
Yeah, by self-appointment. There was, everybody else was gone. Pierre Salinger was on an airplane going to Japan with a group of cabinet officers. Mack Kilduff was down with the president's party in Texas. Andy Hatcher, it was a good Friday afternoon, was out at the Laurel racetrack where he should have been. And I heard about it sitting in the White House mess. Jack McNulty came in, and couldn't believe it. Nobody could believe it. And then I realized that there was a TV set in the press secretary's office. At that time, that was the only place there was a television set. when Johnson came around, a few other television sets showed up, I must say. But I went up there, and there was Helen Gans, a nice elderly woman who'd been in that office many times, and a young girl, and they were crying. And we were watching the television as everybody else was. Mm. And I could tell, as the White House press with the big boys were down and girls were down with the party in Texas. But now all of a sudden they started pouring in. And I just had to take Step over in. And say, oh,
was what a day. I'm sure all of that still sears your memory, those you march in his procession and all the rest of it as well.
Yes.
To your great credit, LBJ was very grateful that you were willing to remain in the administration after this and become counsel to him. But of course, Lee, it's a very different White House. It's a very different man. Just describe briefly what it must have been, a very abrupt change in style, and almost, I could imagine, almost every dimension.
Yeah, it was a jolt. I used to joke to say I was just getting used to saying Cuber the way you're supposed to say Cuber and Viga.
Right.
Now all of a sudden I got to be y'all. Hi y'all, I'm fine. So that's the surface, but it was a totally different human being. Mm-hmm. I'm no psychiatrist, but President Johnson had a tough job to follow a martyred president. And I think he was not as comfortable as he should have been because of his own background. He sees all these Ivy League folks sitting around, and he's from San Marcos State Teachers College in West Texas. He was probably the shrewdest, brightest guy in the room.
Yeah.
But I know that there was some difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
But boy, was he a legislative genius. He knew exactly how to move things through the legislative process.
Mm-hmm.
In my simple way of looking at it, he would have a target. He'd put a bill up there. And everything that came his way would be focused on that particular bill until it was passed.
Right.
One time there was a group of civil rights leaders in the White House.
Who came there actually to criticize him.
Right? Oh, yeah. Well, they had some problems, and then we were at the meeting, and President Johnson says to me, tell Larry O'Brien to bring down his tally sheet. O'Brien was the congressional liaison. And he said, there's a bill coming up. He said, I don't know what you folks all want. But he said, listen to this bill. He said, this is an education bill. And I got to tell you, we need some help.
He gave him all assignments.
Larry said, tell him, who do you need in Alabama? Which one of you fellows can handle Alabama? Which one you can take this one?
Mm-hmm.
And those guys marched out up to the hill doing his lobbying.
And of course, he again, perhaps even more so than John Kennedy, is identified with civil rights and then the great legislative advances that were made. First of all, and it was mentioned just today, I heard one of the political candidates speaking to the AIPAC convention here, and he mentioned the Schwerner, Goodman, Cheney tragedy in Mississippi when the three young men were murdered, and two of them were from New York, and the other young fellow was from Mississippi. Their names will live on forever. Their parents, I think one still survives, were obviously overwhelmed and distraught. You recommended he meet with those parents, did you not? And you made it happen?
Well, it's a little different. But yes, I had a phone call from a congressman from Manhattan, mm-hmm. Bill Ryan. He represented the Goodman family that were in his district.
Right.
So he calls and he says to me, the parents of the missing civil rights workers, meaning the Goodmans from Manhattan, Schwerner from Westchester County, and Mrs. Cheney from
Mississippi,
mm-hmm. want to see the president. Well, why? Well, just to see that there is an intensive effort on the part of the federal establishment to find those young men. So I go down and I say to the president, Bill Ryan just called, and we're standing, he's 6'4", I'm 5'7", and we're standing. I said, the parents want to do that. He said, well, I'll tell you, it's June now. He said, if I see these parents, I'm going to have to see all the other parents, if there are a situation. I said, well, it's not only that we're deciding whether to invite them, I got to go back and tell Ryan, who's asked on behalf of the parents, Yeah, he said, that's right. You got to go back and ask them, and tell him no. And I said, well, I'm not only telling him no, I'm also telling Congressman Brownie Reed, Whitlaw Reed, who was the representative of the Schwerner family in Westchester County, New York. And don't forget, I'm saying nicely, that that family owns a Herald Tribune, New York Herald Tribune. And there's going to be an article in that paper saying, President refuses to see parents of missing civil rights workers. Now, he's getting a little bit annoyed. He's getting very annoyed at me, but he's also getting annoyed at the Herald Tribune for running that damn article. And over in the far corner of the big room is Jack Blunney on the telephone looking out, and Johnson sees me, and he doesn't want to quite yell at me because he doesn't know how I'm going to take it. He says, Blunney, every time I come out here, you're on the damn telephone. And guess what? He saw them.
He saw the parents.
He saw the parents.
Yeah.
And it turned out such a great tragedy. But at the time that he was meeting with them, J. Edgar Hoover reported that they had found the station wagon. So there was at least a glimmer of hope.
Mm-hmm.
But that's part of my story of how you can tell the boss you're not doing it right and still not get fired.
I should say that story of how to tell the boss how to do it right, not get fired, and do it with humor is really the major theme of this book.
Yeah.
I mean, that is just, if you could almost make this a manual for how to conduct yourself in these circumstances with art and style and get things done. And in that connection, and here's something I think I do have the facts right on, Lee, I think you're cutting your grass one day. this is the Voting Rights Act.
Correct.
That's been passed by Congress. And everyone who saw it then, who has seen it since on film, remembers that LBJ went before a joint session of Congress, which, you know, it happened a handful of times in our history.
You're right. I was cutting the grass. I have teenage kids, but I found it's easier to cut the grass than to get them to do it. So here I am out there, and we're about to send a message to Congress on the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Normally what we do, especially in those days, where we use mimeographs. And we would cut a stencil, and we would send it up. And I think to myself, you know, it might not be a bad idea to see if we can do this in a fancier way. And so I came up with the idea of having a joint session of Congress. And I went to the office on Monday, and I said to Bill Moyers, to tell the president, maybe we can do this instead of sending it up routinely with mimeographed copies. Maybe we can have a joint session of Congress. He said, you tell him. I said, no, you tell him, because he'll listen to you. He said, you tell him. So I told him. President listens, calls up John McCormick, the Speaker of the House. He said, John, he said, how'd you like to invite me to come up and make a speech on the Voting Rights Act? And, of course, as you say, the rest of it is well known. It was a boffo.
Boffo indeed. You know, and the importance of things like that, Lee, speaking of someone who saw it, is that that's the kind of thing that sinks deep into the public consciousness. The fact that, the president could have signed something or issued a statement or, you know, any number of things, but that's what made an impression on the public.
Powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he was not a great orator, but he was at the top of his form at that night. And, of course, the clincher at the end was, and we shall overcome.
Exactly. That was, and when you rank the emotional moments in American history, that's going to be well into the top 10, probably in the top 3.
And he knew at the time and told everybody who would listen that, we got to do this, but boy, are we going to take a pasting in the Democratic Party in those southern states for at least a generation.
I was right about
that.
Well,
it's turning around now, and pretty soon we're going to see that increasingly the Democrats are getting elected. But we had a dry spell there for a long time.
Yeah. You knew his politics. After your service with the Johnson administration and before your time in private law practice, you were chairman of the Federal Power Commission, of which a separate book could be written, or about which a separate book can be written. But as I read those chapters and those anecdotes, Lee, I got the feeling that you are head of an agency, a regulatory agency, who the public may not, and I certainly did not, fully grasp its importance to this country. In other words, energy use and regulation were something we ill understood perhaps in those times.
Yeah, it wasn't at the top of the list.
Mm-hmm. Both in terms of the government and perhaps in terms of the people.
Yes, but I remember very, very clearly my feelings as I got there. See, I had spent quite a few years, 15, 16 years, staff for two senators, two presidents. Now, all of a sudden, I'm not a staff man. I've got my own vote. I've got my own reputation, and I get to do whatever I want.
Right.
Within reason, obviously, and I've got colleagues, but I felt emancipated. Because when you're a staff person, I think if you do it right, you have to be very careful how you're using your principal's name and reputation. You know, I could write some silly thing, and Senator Cooper would say, no, no, no. But if I always left him room to make it tougher, he'd say, I think we can be a little stronger on that, Mr. White.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay.
Yeah.
But now I am on my own.
And on your own, and you did it magnificently. And the Cooper you mentioned, of course, was the famous John Sherman Cooper of Kentucky.
Yes.
One of the great giants.
Well, tremendous human being.
To learn about him and your time with him and so much more about government, I really recommend Government for the People, Lee. And I'm so glad you wrote it.
Well, thank you.
I learned as I read, and I laughed, too.
Well,
and I think everyone should learn and read and laugh from this book. Lee White, thank you for your service to this country.
Well, thank you, George. I like this program that you're engaged in, and I hope that people will benefit from it, especially young people. And I think right now we're going to see a lot of young people, especially with the nominee, Mr. Obama.
Coming back into government. I join you in that.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Lee White. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our production engineer is Sharana Harris. And our assistant producer is Keila Jackson. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.